everyone, and welcome back to the Propanon Podcast. I'm your host, Gabriel Kennedy, a.k.a. Propanon. And in this episode, I speak with Dara Mason, the Irish award-winning travel photographer, host of the Spirit Box podcast, and author of Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, Lord of the Crossroads. The book is, among other things, a study of the devil of folkloric witchcraft, specifically in the form of the Dark Man. Through his archival research into Irish folklore and documents from the Scottish witch trials and contemporary interviews, Mason unpacks the phenomenon of the Dark Man to reveal a complex representation of the spirit of nature. In our conversation, I spoke with Dara about his research into this character, how he met the Dark Man while doing occult rituals, and what message this fearsome being has for humanity at this time. And finally, what are Dara's thoughts on the Pooka? What first drew you to the figure of the Dark Man? And, when did you realize he was more than just sort of like a folkloric character and whatnot?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I spotted the theme a lot in Irish folklore, particularly in kind of reading the collections from like the late 1800s, from the kind of Gaelic revival, like Lady Wilde's collection. I can't remember the full name. It's quite a long name for that book. It's like I think it's fairy tales, cures and curses and what have you. It's Oscar Wilde's mum. So She aggregated all these stories and put them together. It's a really, really great book. And I was reading through kind of the fairy tales and kind of other collections of fairy tales. And I just started to notice this pattern of this kind of sometimes quite background figure, this kind of sinister figure that would be the instigator of some kind of like plot line that would challenge the kind of the protagonist in the tale, right? Not necessarily in opposition, but certainly would kind of like flick that first domino. And those questions tend to be around kind of moral conundrums, like moral questions. What are your values? That kind of thing. Or, you know, an individual stays up at a party too long when they should have gone home. Then they've got to walk the road at night. And what happens on the road at night? They come across this dark figure, you know, who offers them a wager of some description, right? So I noticed that mechanic in stories to the point that, like, I think it might have been, I don't know, maybe like 2018 or 2019, I put one of my first-ish YouTube videos up talking about the Dark Rider, right? This kind of figure that turns up in these stories, and gave it kind of a, read out a couple of stories on that figure. And then that was around the start of Spirit Box, my podcast. And the whole kind of objective of Spirit Box was the idea of kind of like talking to people who've had experiences with the spirit world, exploring kind of esoterica, magic, and kind of the paranormal more broadly, you know, just to kind of look at all sides of the cube, you know, look at it all from every angle. And kind of, you know, I've had priests on the podcast, all kinds of stuff, you know, so and to be really open to hear the different perspectives, right? And I had a number of witches on the podcast. And they started to talk about, was Aidan Wachter actually in particular, talked about kind of a man in black kind of zapping him in vision, and it manifested in his room. It was one of the early shows, his first show on Spirit Box. And that kind of, you know, initiated him into magic, set his life on that path. I mean, he was probably always heading that way as well, right? But it kind of was that push that kind of seal the deal. So when he said that, I was like, black figure again, and I kept noticing that motif. So that's kind of when it kind of transitioned from being this folkloric figure that was ambiguous in terms of its definition. It was like the king of the fairies, lord of the dead, the folkloric devil, you know, and but it always had that kind of identifying characteristic of this interrupted journey that either black in terms of description or their name referred to them as black in some way. And when we say black, like, we don't mean kind of an ethnicity, like it's a literal, this person's dressed head to toe in black, that kind of thing. So that's kind of when I started noticing it. It was just more of a trend. I was picking it up then in kind of in books that I was reading about witch trials and how accounts where a black man turned up and, you know, after someone died and kind of told the widower that the widow rather that she could have an income if he would give her an income if she kind of swore to him, that kind of thing. And it was just kind of a breadcrumb from there. They, you know, went deeper into kind of the witch trial stuff, and there was just heaps and heaps and heaps of it, you know. Emma Whitby's work was quite significant in cataloging so many of those accounts. Scottish Witchcraft, Scottish Witch Trial Database, another great resource. And it's certainly not universal on the witch trial stuff, but there's a lot there, and they tend to share common traits. So that's really it. It was kind of like spotting it in folklore first, to the point where I was talking about it thematically in stories, and then the more I kind of started to interview people from a magical perspective, that was when I started hearing more and more. I mean, people who are very good friends now, in the early stages of our friendship, you know, having to be telling me about, like, I'm having dreams about it, like a dark man standing over my bed, this kind of stuff, you know, like, and they were magically related. So it began to orbit me, you know, everywhere I turned. It's like that kind of Spider-Man meme, they're all pointing at each other. Everywhere I turned, there was like some sort of dark man kind of a layer presenting itself. So yeah, that's kind of it. To the point where I'm like, there's something here. There's something that I want to write about. And lo and behold, I looked into the Irish Folklore Collection, the website Dukas.ie, and explored some of the Irish language collection there from the schools. Folklore work that was done in the 1930s. And I started searching for Far Dirk or Far Dove, which is dark man or the black man in Irish and Gaelic, and loads came up, you know. And some of those made them into the book.
You know, it sounds as if there was a moment of inspiration that sort of really got this book going. You know, like, what was the personal experience, say, with this archetype? Yeah.
Well, when I look back at it now, I mean, there was certainly kind of the flashpoint that accelerated things. But when I look back now, and I think this is the same for a lot of people when they kind of have an experience like this, they can see that, again, breadcrumbs go way back in time, you know, right, and right. A lot of that has got to do with kind of the assumption of, you know, we're experiencing time in a very different way to these royal entities are, right? These super entities are. Indeed, it kind of like our family line or incarnation line could be perceived like pearls on a string as opposed to individuals by these kind of, you know, super beings, ultra terrestrials, or whatever, you know, whatever they are, whatever label you want to use. So you kind of start to look back in your life and kind of go, okay, what was that? You know, what was that? But why did I have that experience? Why was I kind of, you know, focusing on a particular nuanced or kind of weird kind of fear when I was like 13, you know, and like you start to kind of look back and you know, hands in the air, there could be a certain amount of kind of coping with that. But I'm of the mind that kind of this has kind of always been with me now. Mm-hmm. Right. But the kind of definitive factor came, I think the November after lockdown, if I remember correctly. I don't know, the years have all kind of merged into one after lockdown. I don't know.
Right.
But I was doing thelemic work. I was looking at thelema, very, very basic stuff, but I was doing kind of Libra Resh and a middle pillar meditation. And I was about a week into it. Whenever I did the middle pillar stuff, like noticeable little things initially started happening. Like I used to have a poster of like the Tree of Life on my wall. And it only happened when I was doing this meditation, a corner would like peel off, right? It's a very small thing, but I'm like, it's a bit weird that it's happened like three times, you know, when I'm doing this every day for a week. That only happens when I'm doing a meditation, right? And I'm trying to do it at the same time, all that kind of stuff. To the point where you're noticing it, right? Anyway, I move location in my house and I'm sitting down, I'm doing this meditation, and I have an immensely immersive vision, right? I'm doing the meditation, and then all of a sudden it's like the scenery just changes in my mind's eye, and I've seen this kind of like incredibly vivid like wall of fire, you know, with this eye staring at me, you know, and like it's so real that I could feel the heat of it. Like it wasn't just kind of like this is like ultra HD 4K vision, as opposed to kind of your kind of normal grainy, maybe patchy mind's eye. This was like incredibly sharp, but I could all, it was somatic. I could feel it, you know. And then this figure emerged. This kind of statuesque, muscular silhouette. And as that emerged, I was shown this the sigil of Lucifer. I was shown the image of the Génie du Mal, you know, which is a famous carving of Lucifer. So symbols that would mean something to me, that I would know what they were, as I guess identifiers. And then it took off vertically, and all the time it's jet black against these flames, and I felt like I was shooting up with it. It's kind of that feeling of like, you know, when you go down like a really fast lift, you know, and you're kind of, it makes your guts catch up with your body when it stops.
Right.
It's like kind of weird feeling. It was like that. Like it felt like I was just going, you know, down a roller coaster super quick, but up. And then it stopped, and I stopped all magical practice immediately. I was super freaked out. I was like, okay, I've really bitten off more than I can chew here. That is not what I was looking for. In fact, in retrospect, I don't know what I was looking for, but it wasn't this, right? So I mean, you know, in common parlance, I fucking shit myself. I was like, all right, I don't want this, and I'm out, right? And I didn't talk about it for maybe 2 or 3 months, until I caught up with a friend of mine who I trust. Told her about it, and she was like, that doesn't happen in the middle pillar. And it's like, only I know you, you know, I would say that's a crock, but you know, I can tell you're telling the truth. And then from there, I started working with a psychic friend of mine, to really start to piece together and kind of work through it and figure out what's going on, you know. And even back then, we did these like lots of divining on it. And even back then, it was like, there's books coming, you know. And that was it, you know. I started doing a vast amount of research. It turns out a lot of the books I would need, I already had. And the book came hard and fast, you know. And you, like in the last chapter of the book, I give the account, right? You know, and I talk about going to the moors at midnight to essentially, you know, invoke them. And 2 days later, I have a publisher calling me, you know, my current publisher called me, you know, so that's the door was very, very, very much open for me to do
right on
the writing, you know.
Yeah, it's great last chapter. But what strikes me about this entity that describes itself as Lucifer to you and whatnot, and you know, it coincides with what you're exploring with the book.
Yeah,
is, you know, how helpful and kind of healthy this entity is, like the advice that, you know, it gives you, and it's basically like inspired you to push yourself artistically and to make healthy choices, perhaps, you know, turn the computer off and get outside and get some fresh air. You know what I mean? You know, right now there's God is telling people to murder people, but Lucifer is telling you to just take care of yourself.
Yeah, I mean, there was a hell of a lot of that. Like them to, you know, challenging me on diet, challenging me on kind of like my physical health and what I'm inputting into it. Mm. You know, like there was a period where I just like, I was having this kind of communication in various different ways, you know, pretty frequently. And some of it was like, there was almost different voices too, that aspects of the same current, but like slightly different voices, like one part mercurial, one part kind of more Saturnian, you know, which kind of leans into this idea of like there's no true form to the dark man, there's no true name, you know, like others would hear Samuel for him, you know, or those would hear just so many different names, which is why I talk about the different figures that seem to carry its current, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's archetypes of this current rather than a deity, right? Or a singular entity. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can remember kind of meditation and going, you know, I started this project and hearing a really distinct, you know, message in my head and literally say, you could get the fuck on with it. Like that abrasive of like, just get on with it. Stop mucking around, you know? So where it's very direct, almost bawdy in some ways, you know, and that kind of leans into some of the kind of the witch trials accounts, that kind of bawdiness, that earthiness to them. You know, so there's very many facets, and other times almost monosyllabic. You know, certainly in the Dartmoor stuff, I mean, just saying, I asked, like, what do you want? And I just heard the word right. That was it. Mm. You know, and the whole, I mean, I know that in a way I probably sound like casual where I'm talking about this, where it was not casual. I want to be really clear with that. It was fucking terrifying all the time, you know, like I was in deep water, you know, with this, and that presented a lot of challenges, you know, where you have to face into things that are very uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah. I'd imagine that it would kind of add a few other psychological pressures, if you will, to your daily life of just seeking to pay rent and do the laundry and whatnot, you know, and be a father and a professional photographer. Mm. And, but you know, it's really what strikes me. I didn't know this, that you mentioned that you're doing a little bit of thelemic work and working with, you know, Lieber Resch and what was the other thing you were working with? Oh, the middle pillar. And, but you know, Lieber Resch is sort of all these adorations to the sun. And you envisage this fiery burning eye, you know, that sort of strikes me as a certain, you know, tropical similarity, if you will. But another thing, though, is that, you know, I was the way that this entity communicates to you through the, you know, through your work, and you write this in the book about, you know, speaking through almost synchronicities, if you will, auditory voices, images, and also sort of bibliomancy. You found that the books that you needed were the books in your library, and you perhaps just open right to the page. You know, this really reminds me in some ways of, you know, what Robert Anton Wilson was discovering when he was working with the Thelema system during the 70s. And this, what Crowley, according to him, was pointing people towards is their communication with their holy guardian angel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wonder if you've thought about that a little bit, if you've given a little bit of thought to that, like the sort of similarities and contrasting things, though, too, because it's not exactly that.
No, it's not. It's because it led me very much to it led me very much to witchcraft in terms of practice and in terms of, you know, a belief system of sorts, right? Like it led very much to kind of a variation of nature worship, you could say, through kind of a witchcraft prism of some kind. But, you know, the experience I had, you could probably say is similar to like a HCA experience, you know. But the caveat I would say was like, you know, I'm doing super basic kind of entry level, like the Lima, and then boom, right? So it's like, I wouldn't want to insult Telemites out there going like, HCA fucking week two, you know. Perhaps it's an adjacent experience. I don't know, but I did think about that life for sure.
Right. I mean, you know, the metaphor of the current and whatnot, similar to sort of thelemic talk. And of course, I mean, like, respect to that system, there's a whole system of invocations, et cetera. But perhaps though, man, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you were doing work within this Wiccan system already. Maybe the psychic engines were already turning and whatnot. And
I think that's probably it. I think it was actually some of the thelemic work did enough to kind of switch on, like, light body, that I was more receptive, and then the entity that wanted to work with me and push me in this direction was like, right, we're on. You know, I also think some of this comes through daemons as well. I think there's kind of like, there's that kind of like super intense kind of like direct communication. And then there's that kind of like continual work through your daemons, kind of that are guiding you in that direction through your creative abilities.
And also, you mentioned in the book, and you were just kind of describing it, this notion of the witch's blood, which that's a powerful metaphor or an image or whatnot. And that you found within this, the sessions that you were doing with your friend, the psychic. This connection of was that were these visions that you got, or did she tell you that you had someone in your paternal line that had made contact with the dark man or whatnot? Like, what was that story, real quick?
A lot of this stuff was like guided meditations to get you to a place where you could then almost a type of scrying. Like where you'd go kind of deep into trance, get you to a place, and then, you know, like you know, part of the meditation would be like reach into the pool and take what's out of the pool for you, right? You know, and like what I took out immediately then connected me to ancestors, and I had pictures of flashes of kind of their lives and kind of where some of this may have started, that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, it's very hard to describe. It's one of those things that makes sense when you're doing it. Like, we're trying to describe it afterwards. You're like, sure, buddy. Because it is, it's almost like a fever dream type, you know, experience. But this is it's kind of an idea that's prevalent enough in witchcraft circles, of the idea of like what I termed a fire in the blood, you know, that there's a potency in there that witchcraft can unleash, and like the dark man is I guess one of the engines that can spark that fire of illumination in one's blood.
There's the surrounding kind of cultural envelopment of this, maybe discussion within Irish culture and maybe some Scottish peasantry culture from
a
few hundred years ago. And that's always something very interesting too, how, I mean, this is one of the things that the Irish are sort of tagged with, you know, this land of great mysticism and, you know, communication with, you know, the other side and whatnot. And I mean, so you grew up in Ireland. Growing up, were there stories around in your zones?
Because Yeah, totally. Like where I live, there was like an elderly bachelor farmer who lived close to us, and we invited him up for Christmas dinner one year when I was about 15 or something. And like I specifically asked him, like, you know, are there any ghost stories around here, you know, that kind of thing? Or, and he's like, just heaps of stuff came out of him. Like he was like, you know, he'd grown up in that area and like talked about riding his bike down the roads, down a little boarding, and you know, a pretty girl appeared on his crossbar as he was cycling through, you know, and then like disappeared while he was like halfway down the road, or the devil's footprints were seen across the snow, you know, that kind of thing. And there was fairies up behind my house. That was like literally behind your backyard, there's fairies, and that seen giants up there, all that kind of shit. Like there's just like loads of stuff. And you know, it's still very much in living memory there. You know, those fairy trees, you didn't touch white thorns or black thorns, you know, like those, that those still taboos like that. You know, even my parents who were, you know, ostensibly from Dublin would be like, yeah, you probably shouldn't touch those trees, you know? Mm-hmm. So that stuff's very much alive and well. Now I found out years later that when my folks were building the house, my mum took it upon herself to go up to that land and leave some offerings for the fairies there and say, like, you know, can we get permission to live here? Which really kind of blew me away when she told me that, like, literally, what, 30 years later, I was like, fucking hell, man, that's interesting. But so, you know, stuff like that was very much part of people's lives, you know? Yeah. And I think in some areas it still is. Like you scratch the surface, and you know, the fairy belief in ghosts, the banshees, all that kind of stuff is there. Mm. You know, I know quite a few people very close to me who've seen both, you know, fairies, pixie type fairies, seen the banshee, that kind of stuff. You know, I know what you mean. I think it's just one of those places where the veil is thin, you know. I think it's just one of those like wild places, particularly on the West Coast, you know. They can stick all the Atlantic, this is the Atlantic way, you know, cool marketing as much as they want, but still wild. That's a tourist reference for anybody who doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about there.
Well, for sure. I mean, so, you know, you did definitely weave the story of the dark man into this sort of broader cultural historical narrative. You know, let's talk about that a bit. You know, you touched on the fact that you sourced some, you know, Irish manuscripts. You speak of the Scottish witch trials of Isabel Gowdy. I'm curious though about the Irish manuscripts that you accessed. Just very briefly, what was maybe the most striking thing that came out for you with all that?
Probably the most striking was that there was a repetitive theme of a fairy woman being turned into a deer with a dark a dark man type figure kind of dominating the story or being one of the key drivers of the story. That happened several times. So like where essentially what I looked at was the Fenian cycles, which are the stories of the Fianna, which are this kind of like band of kind of like noble knights, for want of a better term, but these kind of warriors who were like great athletes, incredible fighters, poets, and you know, kind of like you know, kind of mastery of both kind of mind, heart, and strength, all this kind of stuff. And the kind of the oldest compilation of Fenian's stories is on Colum na Seanáireachta, which is called in English the colloquy colloquially of the old men or colloquially of the ancients. And the text is made up of three manuscripts, two from the 15th century, the Book of Lishmore and Laud 610, and there's a third piece from Killiney in South County Dublin, and that's dating from the 17th century. But we're talking about these tend to be copies, right? So linguistic evidence and how the language is written and grammatically structured kind of links it back to earlier texts like the 12th century. Now, and bearing in mind, these manuscripts are essentially the monks of the time, the Celtic Christian monks documenting the stories of the land, right? So these are far long kind of oral history. You know, these were kind of performed stories, performed by Shanachie's storytellers. Now, that's why the book's called Song of the Dark Man, because it's leaning into that performance of storytelling and you know, sitting somewhere around the kind of the creative element that happens with him in whatever way he manifests in people's lives. So that was kind of the primary manuscript that we look at for these stories. But I looked at a lot of later versions of similar stories of Oisin, like Celtic Myths and Legends by T.W. Rawlson, Joseph Stevens' book, Irish Fairy Tales. But what you have overall is, it could be kind of bounce around a bunch of different manuscripts. I'm sorry with this, because what happened is in the Cloaky of the Ancients, right, you have a story where Culture MacRonan Culture MacRonan is one of the Fianna, and he is lured to the kingdom of Don Dove. Right, Don Dove is the Lord of the Dead. Mm-hmm. Now, Dove means black in Irish. Now, what Don Dove does to kind of bring the Fianna to his otherworldly fort, Lady Mal, in the form of a deer, to lead them on this hunt that takes him into the other world, to the land of the dead. Now, in the metrical Dinshachanas, which is a collection of essentially legends, where it's kind of like a false history of the names and places of Ireland. Right. Again, this is a very old, it's 12th century stuff, right? Collated by the monks around. This is how these places got their names, right? Mm-hmm. And it would be some wild story. Right. There's a story called a poem there called Fafland, which is around a woman who is on the run from these evil spirits who turn her into a deer and eventually chase her and kind of kill her with evil sorcery. She's a fairy woman again. Mm. So that's two accounts. Now, the primary account that I describe in the book is where we have the story of the appearance of Oisin, right, who is the son of Finn McCool. And these are quite important here, right, because Oisin literally means little deer or little fawn, right? Fionn is, or in kind of English would be Finn, but it is a reference to kind of lightness or white, right? So we see him denoted as the white, representing that I guess, light, right? Now, the story of Oisin and his conception in these kind of later stories of like T.W. Rawlson and James Stevens, and it talks about how Fionn is out hunting, and his dogs find this fawn, and the dogs won't kill the fawn. They kind of nuzzle it, they lick it, and it's treating it like it's a friend, and instead of doing what they're trained to do, which is to bring the animal down and finish the job for Fionn. So you know something strange here. So he brings the fawn back into his fort, and that night his chamber door opens, and the most beautiful woman he's ever seen enters the chamber. She's just magnificently beautiful woman, and she pleads to Fionn for his assistance, for his protection, that he's under her roof. Will you protect me? And he's like, well, you know, against who? And she's like, the in the two later stories, it's like the black magician of the Men and God, or the dark druid, right? That's the kind of figure. So that's your dark man figure. And she explains that she's essentially a fairy woman. She's come from the land of the young. She's on the run from this black magician of the Men of God, who wishes to marry her. She doesn't want to marry him because she loves another. And Fionn is like immediately kind of jealous. Who's this other person that she loves? You know, you can assume fairy glamour is happening at this time. And she's like, it's you. You're the one I love, right? So they're instantaneously together, and they have a few short, joyous months together. And
the honeymoon Fionn period,
yes, exactly, yeah. So this the woman's name is Sive. So she, Fionn is called away on his military duties to fight off some Vikings who are raiding Ireland. She waits on the kind of on the battlements, dutifully for his return, and she sees what appears to be Fionn coming up the fairway to the fort, and runs out to greet him. Now, once she's outside the protective boundaries of the fort, and she gets closer to what she thinks is Fionn, it's the dark man. It's the dark druid. He transforms into himself again. This black druid touches her on the head with a hazel wand, and she disappears forever, and she's never seen again. So Fionn is absolutely distraught by this. He's destroyed. He wanders Ireland for 7 years looking for her. He never finds her until he finds this small little blonde boy who his countenance reminds him of himself and of Sive. And the boy describes, I come from a faraway place beyond this mist, and there was a deer who was kind to me, and she looked after me. But there was a frightening man in black that would come sometimes. Sometimes he'd be kind to the deer, and sometimes he would beat us, but he brought us food. So we know that's Oisin, right? So the boy is christened Oisin, little deer. And he's half fairy. And this is how the dark man starts this whole myth and legend going, with the birth of Oisin, who becomes like one of the more notable heroes of Irish lore. Now, what's interesting as a tidbit about this, in the roots of Oisin's story go back to the 12th century at least. And in a couple of marginal quatrains in the Book of Leinster, Oisin's mother is called Blaidh Dearg, and was in the form of a deer when Oisin was conceived, right? Which is a very different story. Mm-hmm.
Kind of cryptozoology story.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. Well, this whole thing of the woman in as a deer is inverted in the Scottish witch trials, where you have the opposite. The dark man appears as a deer and sometimes lies with witches in the form of a deer. Mm-hmm. Right? So you have this inversion. But the inversion is representation, to quote Joshua Cutchin, when we get into this kind of fairy world. Now, where I started to kind of track this idea where we have the black magician of the Men of God, or the dark man of the she, as he's described, I said the black magician of the Men of God, but the dark man of the she being the fairy, and the black magician of the Men of God is a specific reference that essentially is saying the Tuatha Dé Danann, right? That this is the black magician of the Tuatha Dé Danann, because the Tuatha, who are these kind of mythic Irish pantheon of gods, mm-hmm. Where the Tuatha Dé Danann is essentially means kind of like people of the god, right? That's what it means. So the men of God is an oblique reference to the Tuatha Dé Danann. Don Dubh, who I mentioned, the Lord of the Dead, Dáithí Ó HÓigean, who is a fantastic Irish scholar on folklore, he essentially says that Don Dubh, Don in modern Irish means brown, but in ancient times the adjective usually signified dark, right? So the character Don is perennially associated with the shadowy realm. And but he is he's represented as kind of an ancestor of all those who die. So that leans into the whole kind of like psychopompic element to it, right? But his name seems to be originally an epithet for the deity known as the Dagda. The Dagda is one of the two of the Danann, right? So here we have this kind of folkloric connection through name, through epithet, through behavior that links these characters together. That I say they are carrying this dark man current in some way. Mm-hmm. And the Dagda is a very interesting figure because he is the consort of the Morrigan. He carries a club around, or you know, that the top of which can give life, the bottom of which can take it away. I can't remember the exact order, whether it's top or bottom, but like he's got the power of life and death, right? And he's quite a kind of a, he depicted as kind of like quite a primitive, wildish looking man or god. So this is what we have, is we have this kind of linkage of these different deities that are carrying this motif through this fairy woman as deer, linking them all together. And in Isabel Gowdy's account, she talks about seeing the devil manifest, whom they call Black John, right? And said, where is it in here again? She says that sometimes he would appear as a great black metal man, so a big kind of like rough man, sometimes he would appear in the form of a ray, right? So, but a ray is an archaic Scottish word for roe, so roe deer. So,
or for sometimes
a roe deer, roe species of deer, right? Sometimes he would have boots on, sometimes he would have cloven feet like those of a deer.
While engaging with this figure sounds, alluring and dangerous, you know, what are some modern manifestations of this, if you will? How is this current being expressed today? I mean, backing up a little bit, the dark man presides over, say, in the Scottish witch trials, the orgies, right? Like, yep. So like these witches, they're getting down, and out comes the dark man with antlers and cloved boots.
Like, if you place them in the time, right, we're talking about like the kind of the 15th century, you know. We have these account of her describing no man's member is as big as his, right? And like, you know, and that he would feel like cold spring water within them. This kind of stuff, you know. Yeah. And no one would deny him this kind of thing. And you get loads of accounts of this, like in the witch trial, the survey of Scottish witchcraft, in that database, like Margaret Alexander in 1547, she referred to a man in black clothes who made her go forward. She spoke of a man being the king of the fairies with whom she had sex with, you know. When pressed, she described his physical nature as cold. So you get these same themes that kind of there's never kind of a definitive one. It's just kind of like you get kind of like almost out of 10 things, you get 7 that kind of lock in that there's a pattern here. And that's really it. It's kind of spotting the pattern, because this is nameless. There's no original name. There's no original form. You know, it's incredible stuff.
It is, yeah. And I mean, you know, it is a slippery character to kind of place. Yeah. Although, like you said, I mean, you have to access your intuition to sort of understand or communicate with this, right? And but however we define them, yeah, the encounter with the dark man often seems to provoke fear. Yeah. So why don't we dig into that a little bit, right? You write about fear as a kind of initiatory threshold. Yeah. You know, so why is fear so central to the dark man's presence? And like, why do you think, or do you think that's one reason why, you know, he presented himself to you as Lucifer?
I mean, it's possible for sure. But the like I kind of identified like kind of five areas that I thought were consistent. There we have the kind of the dark appearance and appellation. We have appearance as a composite being, so that kind of like mix of animal and human. We have shape-shifting, the interceptor or trickster nature. So the intercept, when I spoke at the start of the show about kind of this dark rider that would kind of interject in people's journeys, that's kind of when I first spotted that, right? And then that theme became more prevalent and more prevalent. Like Isabel Gowdy, for example, was walking at home at night outside the church in Aldern, and that's where she met the devil. Her journey was interrupted, you know? So it's like, it's consistently there. And then there's the sex and sexual interest in human beings, which again seems to be fairly consistent. And that's all that, you know, again, those graphic accounts are from like the 17th century, you know, it's just not what you think you'd hear, right? But so the fear element to it, I think this is a test of metal. You know, I that's what I think it is. You know, I think it's that kind of going through the fire of like, can you lean in this or not? Right. Now, if you look back at these kind of like these witches in 17th century Scotland, you know, these people were living on like subsistence farming in a very difficult part of the world to live. You know, you take away kind of modern power, modern convenience, modern fuel away from places like Ireland and Scotland. And some of those places are extremely difficult to survive in, right? You know, there are very harsh winters, not necessarily freezing. They're just wet and windy, you know, mm-hmm. and those things kill people, you know. So a harvest goes badly, then you're gone. You know, one member of your family who was a key breadwinner or who could work, they die, then the rest of you are gone, you know. And what we'd often find is that the dark man or a spirit representing the dark man would appear to these people after some kind of tragedy had happened, something that would have maybe fractured an element of themselves that allowed entry for this to happen. So after the death of a loved one, we find that after accidents, after illnesses, this is when we find the dark man appearing. The fear element to it. Now I can only make assumptions. I can't obviously go, well, it's about this. What I suspect it is about is to shock the mind into seeing something different, seeing the world in a different way. Because everything you've heard about this, particularly if you're growing up in some, you know, some Abrahamic framework, is going to be that's evil. Anything outside of the sanctioned belief system is evil. And I believe this is inherently something to do with the natural world, right? That the dark man may be kind of the kind of penultimate daemon of the earth, right? In which case it's presenting itself as like the true face of nature, you know, which is creative. It's lusty. It's got that driving force to create, to procreate, but it's also tooth and fang and claw. There's those elements to nature as well. And that's all coming through at once. But this, the dark figure is, I think, challenge. You know, can you face into this? But more importantly, can you face into yourself, you know, and really look at yourself? I that's what I think it is. I think it's an almost symbolic representation of that. Well, I can't say that in its entirety, but I, you know, that might sound glib, but from my perspective, like, facing into the fear of what I saw was genuinely terrifying. So mm-hmm. I don't know what this is. I don't know, you know, I don't know what this is going to cost me. Have I bitten off more than I can chew? you know, I feel like I'm in really fucking deep water and I just about got my mouth over the water. So that's what I think that is about.
Shock and psychic pressure, even almost. Mm. Yeah, because you're nearly overwhelmed with this energy of which then you have to seek allies to help you make sense of this and take mm-hmm. this journey to confront this energy. And what do you find at the at the end of that? But again, an inspiring force to kickstart your book. And which I think mm-hmm. is pretty, it's a great story. And before moving on to the next question, the sort of psychic effect that, you know, what is known as the Great Hunger or the Irish Potato Famine, and what sort of effect that may have had on, you know, this belief in the Irish folklore, and do fairies fade away when we stop talking about them?
It's a really interesting question. Like, we really, really underestimate the effects of the famine on Ireland and Irish culture and the Irish identity. And I've no doubt that it there was a lot that happened around that time that would have no doubt involved a lot of witchcraft. You know, when people have nothing and they've got no recourse, they can turn to magic. The cursing and the magic as a leveler. You know, and I certainly would have felt that some, I talk about it in the book, about like, you know, that, again, that kind of living on the edge of Western Europe, like literally the peripheral edge of Western Europe in a not the most hospitable landscape. It's like that you pray to God for salvation and then the devil for survival, you know, so... You think about how many folk practices and taboos are intertwined in the Irish calendar. You know, there was always something going on. Every month there was some kind of Saint's Day, and the Saint Day would have some sort of taboo that was related to the fairies. Butter left outside for the fairies, milk left outside for the fairies, taboos around fairies and cattle and crops and all that kind of stuff. You know, because those things are hedging one's bets against your crop failing, because if it fails, you're done, you know. So I would say there was a hell of a lot that went on at the time. And I can imagine faith in the Catholic faith in Ireland was always slightly mirrored in a way that was integrally tied to identity, because the kind of the British forces were of Protestant and therefore the Irish were Catholic, you know. So that I think that was one of the driving forces that maintained it through those kind of extremely punitive times. Post-famine, the Irish Catholic became far more of a Roman Catholic, which we get into kind of a lot of the you know, taboos and around sexuality. Those things were not as prevalent, my understanding is, pre-famine. Like Crowpatrick, the Holy Mountain in Ireland, childless couples would go and do kind of a pilgrimage to Crowpatrick, crawl up it, go up in their bare feet, you know, these very punitive exercises. But then at the bottom of the mountain where they'd all be camped out, it was like, you know, Woodstock. Everyone was like going for it to conceive a child, you know. So you had these two things, like a very kind of bawdy, orgiastic atmosphere at the bottom of the Holy Mountain. So the kind of the previous version of Catholicism could hold both those things. Now, post-famine, it became a lot more uptight, whereas your firstborn would inherit the land, so the farms would not be segmented amongst the children to preserve their integrity. It was the small holding and that kind of subsistence farming that was wiped out by the blight and not helped by the British. But so that there was societal changes there as well. But the shift in Catholicism, I think, reflects a desperation, and it reflects that kind of old folk elements dying out. But I'm absolutely certain there was plenty of witchcraft at the time.
You know, for those who pass through this sort of initiatory space, this a similar space that you've had in your book, interview and speak with a few people who've also shared this experience.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of, you know, transformation lies on the other side? What sort of wisdom might you have to pass on? I mean, it's in the book, but what do you have off the top of your head?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that, like, this isn't for everybody. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's and that's not saying that kind of like the people who do go this are in some way like special. Like, it's be careful what you wish for, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's because it is frightening, and there are like certainly kind of dark sides to this, you know. And it's extremely frightening, you know. Like, I've friends who've, you know, been told things they don't want to hear, that, you know, that are very, very personal, like, that are challenging. But I think one's understanding of the world shifts. So I mentioned about kind of like Fionn, the name meaning white or fair haired, right? So this is, I think, the one of the key big things with the dark man, particularly in the stories, how it manifests, is this kind of idea of non-dualism, right? That his stories and the ones that he encompassed are essentially showing this metaphor all the time of non-dualism, that everything is connected. So you have, in the stories, is setting up this opposition of light versus darkness, kind of. But then you have like the dark man appearing as Fionn, right? Just as light, you know, darkness contains the light, just how Lucifer, this black angel, as he appeared to me, is the light bringer, right? So it's talking about these kind of two forces are intertwined, and the separation is an illusion of our world, right? And then you have that mirrored in the way where you've got like the theme of human shape-shifting into animal forms, which he manifests as in this composite being form, suggests that we're not separate from the animal world. We're not separate from the world of nature. We're part of nature, you know. And that's a very significant difference to, say, Abrahamic thinking, particularly in the Christian Bible, where it puts, you know, I don't know what passage it is, but like, God has given you the plants and animals of the world to use, right?
Mm.
This is putting you alongside it, not above it, not below it, but alongside it, you know. And in the case of the witches, literally copulating with it, right? So there's that kind of fecundity, that kind of like creative, the procreative force within nature. And then, yeah, you've got the darkness element, which is the shadowing of death, that there's life and death. They're dualistic things, but they're also intertwined, because he is Samael, the Lord of the, you know, the angel of death, and also Don Dove, this Lord of the Dead at the same time. So there's a big non-dualistic element to this, you know. And in that story of like the birth of Oisín is in himself half fairy. He's a non-dualistic metaphor in himself, you know. And in this, like in the story, like Oisín manages to he gets whisked off to fairyland by Niamh Cynor, who is his fairy bride, and longs to come back to Ireland. And he spends like 3 years in fairyland, wants to go home, but he's told, you know, don't touch the ground when you get back. And of course, sequence of events happen that he touches the ground and he ages centuries. Turns out he's in Ireland, he's been away for centuries, and he's in the time of St. Patrick, and you have these debates with St. Patrick. So this is the weird thing about this story. You have a half fairy being, right, debating kind of moral questions with St. Patrick, you know, like, and, you know, those 12th century monks were comfortable enough they could hold both those concepts, you know. But I think the big thing is the non-dualistic nature of the world beyond. Right. And particularly that motif of like life, life contained within the darkness, you know, and that, that ties into this inspiration element as well.
This being a podcast that focuses somewhat on the work of Robert Anton Wilson, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the Pooka. And do you find that has even the talk of the Pooka sort of become reinvigorated in culture? Like when you were growing up, did you ever hear the Pooka?
I would have read about the Pooka. Because I had heaps of this stuff around. Like I read voraciously with Irish folklore, you know. But I would say to a certain extent, it is in the form of the Puck Festival, the Puck Fair down in County Kerry. And it happens at Lunasas, so it's the festival that, you know, the time of harvest. And for those who don't know, the Puck Fair is... it's supposed to be the oldest festival in Ireland. They don't really know when it started. The long and the short of it is they capture a wild mountain goat off the mountain. These big shaggy things with long horns, big long curly horns. And he's crowned King Puck, king of the town. And Queen Puck is a kind of like a beauty pageant of like the local 13-year-old girls, and then Queen Puck is chosen, who essentially is married to King Puck, right? So you have a harvest time, and you have a marriage between the wild and the human world, right? So to kind of say, good harvest next year, let's reestablish our treaty, as it were, is kind of how I see it. And then the goat's released back into the mountain after the fair. But the Puck is the word for the goat, essentially. But its etymology is really interesting. Like it's very kind of cognate with Pooka, mm-hmm. you know, which is... Pooka is also the collective term for kind of a ghost as well in Ireland. Like, but there is this specific being, the Pooka, you know, which can appear as like a... kind of a horse-like being or a large rabbit-like being. It could be white, it could be black. It's non-dualism. It's in there mm-hmm. as well. And if we think about the shape-shifting nature again, it's non-dualistic stuff as well. It can be good luck or it can be very bad luck, you know. So it's interesting. I think it's a very, very good kind of motif for all that kind of non-dualistic stuff, right? And kind of the chaotic forces of nature. Yeah, there's a lot I talk about in the book. There's a heap of cognate terms that relate to Puck, and Pooka is a major part of that. You've got like Bucca Dove, Bucca Dove in Cornwall, which you would say like is which some Cornish witch cults and covens kind of have or relate to or work with. And that Pooka is, I would say, very much cognate to Pooka as well. You know, there's all kinds of mad stuff around it. Even if in Finland, what is it called? It always cracks me up. Finnish, just as a language, just makes me laugh, because I think it's the closest thing to elfish that there is out there. It's like there's a figure called Nukki Putki. And like it looks like a Wi-Fi password, like. But it's like the Yule goat, right? So it's like the Christmas goat. Mm. This figure again goes around essentially trick or treating at Christmas, right? That's kind of what it is. It's a similar tradition of do you want a trick or a treat? You have to come out and sing a song, right? So it's got that kind of like little kind of trickstery nature and. You know, making people kind of engage with the kind of the comedic elements of it. The Nukki Putki, if I remember that correctly, there's some tremendous images of again, a kind of folklore, folk photography of this tradition from Finland. Really, really interesting. But there's lots of that stuff around the fringes of Western Europe. I'm sure it goes more worldwide as well. But so there's lots there around the Puka, for sure.
Yes, thanks again to Darren Mason for taking the time out to speak with me. And make sure to pick up his book, Song of the Dark Man, and check out his Spirit Box Radio podcast as well. There's a couple of interviews on me on there, speaking about my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, which you can get at chapelperilous.us. So until next time, y'all, this has been the Propanon Podcast. Thank you for listening. Peace out.